Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does desire for sex change over the course of a long-term relationship? And what happens when one partner wants more than the other? Although differing levels of desire affect every couple over time, that asymmetry rarely feels normal for couples experiencing it and can be a major source of stress and dissatisfaction. My guest today is here to talk about what causes it and how couples can successfully move past these difficult periods in their relationship to come out stronger in the end. Dr. David Snarsh is a licensed clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of several books, including Passionate Marriage and Intimacy and Desire, Awaken the Passion in Your Relationship. He's in town to speak this evening about the sexual ecology of love relationships to the Simmons School Counseling Program at SMU in Plano. David, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
So you have found that desire problems are so common, they are normal. Why does Mother Nature do this to us?
Well, it's not that Mother Nature has it in for us. Marriages are people growing machines, and they're not easy, but they really are elegant. So all around the world, everybody has the problem that nobody thinks they're going to have. Everybody thinks you're going to get married, and if you're in love, you're going to have sexual desire, and they're one and the same, and this is going to go on. And everybody eventually has sexual desire problems. We've been doing this four-year study on crucible4points.com website. We've had over 20,000 responses, and 77% of people say that their sex life is either asleep and needing a wake-up call, comatose and in danger and dying, or deader than a mackerel. And there's absolutely nothing going wrong. But the biggest problem is nobody expects it. So when it happens, people think that they're either sexually incompatible or they picked the wrong person or they've fallen out of love. And this is simply the way that people develop. Once you get into marriage, when I say marriage, I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about the legal institution. I'm talking about emotionally committed relationships, because we would never develop an approach that systematically discriminated against gays and lesbians. Mm-hmm. They have the exact same issues, plus a couple of others, than straight people do. But what basically happens is, once you get into a relationship and you get to the stage of, do I belong to you or do I belong to me? Then couples start finding sexual desire evaporates, because the issues about selfhood far outweigh the issues about hormones or horniness. And so most of us are brought up on this biological model where you think it's inappropriate not to have sexual desire unless you're excluded with a doctor's note. And so when this happens, everybody thinks that something's going wrong, as opposed to this is just the people growing process. And when you get clear that you belong to yourself, that's when you can share. But well, a lot of people think that there's something that we call communal genitalia. And unfortunately, lots of religions talk about the marital debt. And once you believe that there's a marital debt, you're not interested in having sex.
Yeah, let's talk about the idea of selfhood and how it changes over the course of a relationship. And you write about the fact that early on, you can't see any flaws in your partner, and you can't believe how lucky you are to find this person. Yeah. And then you live with them for a couple of years, and then you see a few things that don't go quite right, and maybe you stop thinking about yourself in quite the same way.
Yes. Well, one of the problems is not that there's a lack of intimacy in marriage. There's usually more than most of us can handle. Most of us have the feeling that we're understood when our partner feeds back to us the delusions we have about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And when your partner starts saying, that's not you, you're like this, and really sees you, then we have the feeling of, oh, you don't really understand
you don't get me.
Yeah, that's right. And so the whole process of tolerating being known in ways that you can't validate yourself, that is basically what happens. And so there are natural processes. This is what we're going to talk about tonight, that the natural processes of emotionally committed relationship end up causing all these problems about sexual desire. So, for instance, if you can tolerate the idea of you and I being married briefly, mm-hmm. and we start dating, and while we're dating, everything's really cool. And then even if we like sex the same way, same frequency, same time of day, it will begin to polarize. Either you like it more than I do in the morning, or you like different positions. But what eventually happens is the issues about selfhood start paralleling. And so it becomes, well, why is your way the right way? Why do we have to do it your way? What's the matter with my way? And that's the issue about feeling invalidated and your partner developing a self. And so what ends up happening is, In the old days, people used to think that there were some couples that had sexual desire problems, and in those relationships, there was a low desire partner. Mm-hmm. And it was the low desire partner that was the problem.
That person's broken in some way.
Yes, we used to call them inhibited sexual desire. And what we began to realize when so many people are having sexual desire problems, what we now say is in all relationships, there is always a low desire partner and a high desire partner. And it's not just about sex. It could be about having kids. It can be about going to the movies. It can be about getting married. And you can be the low desire for intimacy and the high desire for sex. Well, it turns out that all around the world where rape is not tolerated and women are allowed to own their bodies, the low desire partner always controls sex, whether they know it or not, whether they like it or not. It's just the deal. The high desire partner starts making more of the initiations, and the low desire partner decides which one they'll accept, and that gives them de facto control of sex. And that is the way that Mother Nature has set this up. And what that means is that conflict is built into emotionally committed relationships, and it turns out that that's the way the human self develops. So the way that human sexual desire evolved that makes human sexuality quintessentially human also led to the evolution of the human brain, the emergence of the human self, and it all sounds very grand, but that's also why if we were married, we would not be having sex tonight.
One of the things you talk about is this process of mind mapping, which is not nearly, when you read about it, it's not nearly as sort of hippy-dippy as it sounds. This is about really understanding one's own mind and also trying to put oneself into the mind of one's partner. But as you mentioned, it can come with empathy or without empathy.
Yeah. Mind mapping is the application of the absolute latest cutting-edge information about interpersonal neurobiology. And when I first found out about mind mapping, I had the same reaction when I first found out about orgasm. You know, it's like, you know about sex, but when you find out about orgasm, you have this feeling, how could this be going on and nobody told me?
It takes it to a whole new level.
That's right. So it turns out that mind mapping is an innate quality of the human brain where one brain can make a mental map of another person's mind. And this starts about age five or six. So when your child starts making fibs for the first time and you think it's absolutely cute and they're hysterical about this, that is proof positive of the beginning of mind mapping ability. They're trying to implant a false belief in your mind.
What does mom want me to have done?
That's right. Uh-huh. And what makes mom tick? Mm-hmm. So what's going to make mom like me and give me the cookie type thing?
Right.
So couples constantly are mind mapping each other because it's the way the brain works. So this whole idea that couples can't communicate, forget it. That's an old view. We tell couples, look, it took over 1 million years for human beings to learn to communicate, and it's not going to stop because you and your partner aren't getting along. And so couples are constantly mind mapping each other. And so that's how, for instance, when you're dating, you know, you're sitting in the bar and you look across the room and you look at somebody looking at you and they look at you just long enough with that look and you go, bang, okay.
You know what that is.
That's right. And so you learn the opposite when you're dating and your partner isn't interested in sex. You know, you make sort of, you float the trial balloon. You're waiting to see what your partner does and they act like they didn't see anything, right? And that's where at the beginning, you know, you're not sure whether they read it or not. So you amplify it and you do it enough to get clear that you know that they knew that you were interested. And couples communicate on this level of mind mapping, and mind mapping has everything to do with sex and desire. So for instance, if you're insecure about yourself, or for instance, if you're female and you're brought up to be attractive and you're constantly scanning to see who finds you attractive and who does, that's mind mapping. Mm-hmm. If you need to be accepted, the only way that you can know that you're accepted is to map the other person's mind and see what they're thinking. So this thing's going on all the time. And one of the really amazing things that married people do is they pretend that they can't read each other because it gives them more finagle room. Hmm. So it's a lot easier to accept what your partner's doing when they say, oh, I didn't know that you wanted that, as opposed to, I knew you wanted that, and you'll get that over my dead body. And, you know, so mind mapping totally changes the picture about what's going on between couples, and it's very, very important in sex. When you're having sex and you can map your partner's mind, well, that's the best sex there is. Except if you map their mind and you realize that they've tuned you out and they're fantasizing about somebody else.
The map goes where you don't want it to.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. But you can't stop this stuff. And so people play with it instead. and it has very, very far-reaching implications for sex, for in families. There are lots of families that play this game of, oh, we don't know what each other's doing, as opposed to we're constantly reading each other.
When you tell people this, when you call them on it, are they instantly in denial? Do they say, no, I really don't. I have no idea what's going on in his mind or in her mind.
Well, that's where they start. But the task of the therapist is to be able to watch what's going on. And we teach our therapist trainees that you have to have at least 3 data points before you make a move. Because when you say, no, wait a second, I see it different, you've got to be able to rap out. You did this, you did this, you did this. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when a couple comes in and the guy's had an affair and the wife says, you know, how could you do this to me? Yada, yada, yada. And the guy says, well, I thought if I had an affair outside of town and you didn't know, you know, that I didn't think it would hurt you. As opposed to the people who were having sex with the wife's sister in their own bed and saying, you know, I didn't think this would hurt you. And it's like you're acting like you don't know this person. Mm-hmm. And when you can point out, wait a second, why did you just reach over to touch your wife while she's sobbing about the affair that you had? And the man says, well, I could see that she was hurting. It's like, there we are. Mm-hmm. Okay. You just demonstrated you know how to mind map. You don't mind map when it's not convenient, or you're mind mapping and you like screwing 2 women at the same time. You like your girlfriend in the lower part of her body, and you like screwing your wife in the ear. And that's what's really going on. And you know how to handle this affair business for maximum collateral damage. And when people realize that, and they realize people are mapping each other all the time, but the way that we sort of grease the social wheels is, oh, I didn't understand. When we're working with people trying to get them dealing with their childhood, one of the questions that I'll say to them when they tell me, you know, my father did this or my mother did this or she didn't do that, I'll say, we have 2 possibilities and there are only 2 possibilities. Either your mother knew what she was doing or she didn't. Mm-hmm. Both of them are hanging offenses, but one they hang you higher for.
Yeah.
So when we go down that road and people begin to realize about mind mapping, it changes your life, including when you go to the grocery store. You start watching your kids. You start watching what's going on with other people. And suddenly interpersonal relationships make a lot more sense.
Again, we come back to this question that you can understand someone else. It doesn't necessarily mean that what you know about them is going to be what you wanted to know about them.
That's the story of marriage, isn't mm-hmm. it? And isn't that also the story of self-awareness?
Yeah.
Right? Beginning to run into yourself is a shock, and I think that's what marriage is about. Marriage really takes who you are and stuffs it up your nose and really makes the price real high, and then it pushes the best in you to stand up. So this is the transition mm-hmm. to the conversation, because I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and it sounds like, oh, what a terrible thing. He's got a jaundiced view of people and, you know, he's making it sound bad. But our approach is really about helping the best in people stand up. And when you know that your kid is mapping you, that really takes away the finagle room and makes the best in you stand up.
My guest this hour is Dr. David Snarsh. He's a licensed clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of books including Passionate Marriage and Intimacy and Desire, Awaken the Passion in Your Relationship. He'll be speaking this evening about the sexual ecology of love relationships to the Simmons School Counseling Program at SMU in Plano. It's your chance now to ask your questions by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is licensed clinical psychologist and certified sex therapist, Dr. David Snarsh. His books include Passionate Marriage and Intimacy and Desire. He's in town to speak at SMU in Plano to the Simmons School Counseling Program about the sexual ecology of love relationships. The event takes place at 7 tonight, and it's free. You can find more information at the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, David, I think the stereotypical picture of this is that if there are asymmetries in desire for sex in a relationship, and it is a heterosexual relationship, that it's the woman who wants less sex than the man. Reading the book, it didn't sound necessarily like that's always the case.
Not only not necessarily, often it's not. Half the couples that we see for sexual desire problems, the man is the low desire partner. So it's just as common in men as it is in women. It just goes against the social stereotype, so you don't hear about it a lot.
Does that make it worse for couples? Do they feel more somehow messed up because of that?
Yeah, it can. A lot of women are angry because they have the feeling of, wait a second, this is supposed to be your job to be making the initiations. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys have the feeling of being intimidated by women's sexuality. But, for instance, in the old days, the idea was that the high-desire partner was the sex expert and the low-desire partner hated sex. What we find, particularly when woman is the low-desire partner, often she knows more about sex than the high-desire partner. That's why she's the low-desire partner, because she knows that the sex that they're having isn't worth wanting. It's the other one that wants two helpings of this lousy sex that wouldn't know good sex if it bit him in the behind. And so the woman is in a bind because she has to step out of the conventional role where the man's supposed to be experienced, the woman's supposed to be ignorant. And she basically has to say to him, look, this sex is terrible. And his response is always, well, how do you know? And then she has to say, because I had better sex with somebody other than you. And
it's women, never the right answer, I'm guessing.
Well, no, that is the right answer.
Really?
The right answer is, I'm not apologizing anymore for being sexual. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to apologize for everybody I had sex with before I met you. You weren't even in the picture. And then the next thing is, look, I don't want any more of this lousy sex. Now, if you want to have good sex, okay, hold on to yourself. I'll scare the hell out of you and we'll have one hell of a good time here. But see, that involves a woman stepping out of the conventional social role. And women are taught early on from adolescence, you never show a man more eroticism than you think he can handle because he'll turn on you. And so now what we're describing is the people growing machine. This woman is in a bind between whether she's going to tolerate lousy sex and roll her eyes, not out of pleasure because she's having an orgasm for the next 30 years of her life, or is she going to stand up, validate herself, understand she's doing something that might make her husband uncomfortable, but instead of treating him like a little boy and kowtowing to him, she stands on her own 2 feet, gives him a chance to validate himself and to now have sex as equals. And so this is how people grow through their sex. And tonight I'm going to be talking about how sexual boredom is inherently built into emotionally committed relationships. There's nothing wrong. This is a normal relationship. And the only way for people to revitalize that relationship is to grow as people. And that's why I love my work. I'm fond of sex, but I'm much more fond of watching the best in people stand up. And when I do my work, I get to watch this miracle every single day. And that's why I'm so lucky for the work that I do.
What's so interesting, David, about what you're describing is that it is this growth through a kind of risk taking. And so many people think once you're married, the risk taking ends.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's the idea. Your partner is supposed to be the source of security and all the rest of that.
Yeah.
What we teach people is your spouse will be the absolute greatest source of this consternation and difficulty in your life, only second to your children. Mm-hmm. Okay? And this whole idea that your partner is supposed to make you safe and secure, whoever came up with that idea had never been married. They'd never been parent of an adolescent. Loving makes you vulnerable. Just the fact that if you care about somebody, they have a monopoly and they can tool you with it, and also bad things happen. They can die. And so loving is not for weak people. Marriage is not for weak people. But as the first chapter of Passionate Marriage says, nobody's ready for marriage. Marriage makes you ready for marriage. And so we all get married as relatively little kids, unless you're getting married where both of you are 68 years old and you're both widowers and you've gone through the process of losing people. When most of us get married, we need somebody to validate us and make us feel secure. And that's what you get when you first start marriage. But just get a little bit farther in and that will stop, because marriage is not about feelings. Marriage is about making decisions, and you don't get all the decisions you want in marriage. So you get really what's called the two-choice dilemma. Do you want this anxiety or do you want this other anxiety? And those are the only two choices you get very often. And it happens about sex. It happens about having children. Are we going to get married, buy a new car? And when couples begin to realize that sex is not a symptom of the rest of the relationship, sex embodies the way that relationships work, adult relationships work, suddenly people stop feeling bad about sex and they see beyond the sex. So it loses its stigma. You're no longer talking about genitalia. Now you're talking about issues of personal development, and you begin to realize that you don't have to work on your marriage. Your marriage is working on you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Tricia in Plano. Hey, Tricia.
Hi. I am calling to ask, what is the difference between mind mapping and manipulation? It seems to me that mind mapping is maybe a kinder, gentler way of explaining manipulation. And can the doctor please clarify?
Thanks for your call.
Wonderful question. Oh, very good. There is a difference. Mind mapping is the core, okay? So if you're going to manipulate somebody, you're a lousy manipulator if you can't map their mind. All good liars have to be good mind mappers, because you got to know what the other person knows. You got to know what to put in, what to withhold. And the only way you know that you're successful at manipulating somebody is you got to read their mind again. So
you point out sociopaths are mind mappers.
Oh, you're sociopaths. You're in fact, I wrote an article that's on Psychology Today, the blog. It's online. It's called Charles Manson, Please Save Marriage and Family Therapy, because there's a new book by Charles Manson and it has his own thinking in it. And he's talking about mapping everybody's mind. So mind mapping is what sociopaths use to manipulate you. All your great politicians better be good mind mappers, because you got to know which way people want to go. All good liars have to be good mind mappers. And the point is, what can be used for bad is also used for good. So mind mapping is neutral. But parents need to be able to map their children's minds. Children need to be able to map their parents' minds. That's what makes them secure. It's not what the parent says, but if what the parent says lines up with what the kid reads in the parents' minds, then it's low anxiety. So we're talking, you can think of mind mapping like sex, where it's a mistake to teach kids that sex is for love, because it leaves them completely unprepared to deal with the reality that human beings use sex for every single thing, good and bad, in the world. So it's the same thing that's true about mind mapping. Mind mapping is the basis of empathy, but it's also the basis for, as this caller said, manipulating. And so when you begin to think that things like mind mapping or sexuality or intimacy, these are neutral, it's the people. And it's about whether the best in people or the worst in people is standing up and grabbing a hold of this, then you begin to understand about human interactions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. If you've got a question for Dr. David Snarsh, we'll go next to Dallas and speak with Hector. Hi, Hector.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Snarsh.
Hey, Hector.
Question. Can you please talk more about the high-desired individual and the low-desired individual in the dating phase as opposed to being married?
You bet. Something that I really wanted to come back to, because I was tracking when we talked about it before. The fact that the low-desire partner controls sex, very often they don't want to. They're tremendously burdened. They don't want to feel withholding. They just want to be able to feel like they can control themselves. And so there are a lot of women that wishes that they had two vaginas, because they'd keep one for themselves, give the other one to the partner, and everything would be okay. They don't want to be withholding, but it's forced choice. Now, the traditional view is that the low-desire partner is screwed up and the high-desire partner is a happy camper. the high desire partner is as pressured as the low desire partner. And see, that gets lost because it's clear to everybody that the low desire partner feels pressured. And high desire partners never really get a chance to have a voice, Hector. That's why a lot of people like this book. High desire partners feel pressured to accept sex whenever it's offered. They feel pressured to accept sex however it's offered, whatever the style is. You know, when your partner's willing to have sex, that's not the time that you start negotiating and say, no, I want to do it differently, because your partner's going to say you can do without.
Because it may not happen again for however long.
That's right. And so the point is, high desire partners very often feel powerless. They feel like they can't touch their partner when they want to. They feel like they're playing red light, green light, 1, 2, 3, or Simon Says, May I? So the point is, it's equal. The high desire partner feels pressured and the low desire partner feels pressured. When you only see it that the low desire partner feels pressured, you don't understand the system and you'll handle it unbalanced. Now, when you're dating, people very often feel insecure. And also what people don't realize is when you're dating, you're setting up the rules for later on in the relationship. It ain't like you're going to get married and then you're going to renegotiate this thing. So there are some relationships where even when you're dating, the low desire partner runs the show and the high desire partner goes along, and guess what's going to happen later on? There are also relationships where when you're dating, the high desire partner runs the show, low desire partner goes along and is figuring this is the price of admission. And later on, when I feel more secure, then maybe I'll say no.
So that happens even in 2011. People feel like they've got to, in order to sustain the relationship, they have to have sex even if they don't want to.
Oh, yeah. It isn't going to the high schools. The boys now feel obligated to have sex with the girls when the girls are on the prowl because it's not appropriate for a man to say no. And this goes on later on in adult relationships, where it's hard for guys when they're not the high desire partner, because I would think particularly down here in Texas, you know, we're all red-blooded guys, right? It's real hard when you're the low desire partner. So it's highly variable, but there are still rules. And once you understand the rules, then we're just talking about permutations of that. So there are a lot of high desire partners that are dating, and in their relationship, the low desire partner is going along, and the high desire partner has this delusion of this is the way that it's going to continue when things go further on. And that's when they start later on complaining about being duped or being sold a bill of goods. And there are some people who make a contract where they agree to monogamy and then they want to do a bait and switch 6 years into marriage and they want to switch it to monogamy. I'm sorry, to celibacy. So they agree to monogamy, they want to do celibacy. And when the partner says, wait a second, you're changing the deal, then the low desire partner claims fears of abandonment. And in our society, fears of abandonment trump anybody's options. And so the fact that somebody's afraid, well, then that usually carries the day in therapy. Not in my therapy, but in most therapies. And that's why couples get stuck, because it feels inappropriate to say to somebody, I know you don't want to do this. It may make you uncomfortable. And particularly when it's about sex, you're not supposed to do anything that makes your partner uncomfortable if you're the high desire partner. Now, if you're the low desire partner, you're allowed to do things that make your partner uncomfortable, like saying, I'm never having sex with you again. And you promised to be monogamous, and you got them. And so
that's a tough set of conditions right there.
Oh, yeah. But it's very, very common. And so this is the kind of stuff that we deal in my approach to therapy all the time. So Hector's question is dead on the money, because very often people only think of the high desire partner. All they want to do is have sex. And the irony is there are some low desire partners that's only what they'll give them. Men are not Neanderthals anymore. This is the day of the sensitive New Age guy. And there are lots of guys, most of us actually, I shouldn't limit it to guys, most of us want to be wanted more than we want to have sex. And so we get our being wanted through the sex, but it's not reducible to that, because when your partner says, well, I'm only having sex to make you happy, it doesn't make you happy. Because you're not wanted, and what they are deliberately doing is withholding the wanting part. But once they have sex with you, they've sort of shut you up, and it's really hard to say, well, I know we had sex and I had an orgasm, but I still don't feel wanted. And then your partner says, oh, you're so selfish. You're never satisfied. And This is the kind of pushing and shoving that goes on in emotionally committed relationships until people learn to confront themselves. And confronting yourself is one of the most important things there is if you want to be a good marital partner. It's not getting your partner's validation.
That's one of the things you talk about that is where you don't use the word turn off, I don't think, but it's a turn off essentially for people to have to constantly validate the other person, and that reduces desire.
Yeah. This morning I met with the students of SMU in the conflict resolution department where we're going to be talking tonight. They were wonderful, just wonderful. And this is exactly one of the things that came up. So a large percent of them are young women or older women. And so they raised this thing about a guy talked about a case where the guy wanted more validation from his wife. And I said, okay, let's forget that everybody in the room is a therapist. And why don't you just think like you're women? Okay, how many of you want to have sex with a guy that you constantly have to prop up? Nobody raised their hand.
Mm-hmm.
How many of you want to have sex with a guy that you constantly have to validate? Nobody raised their hand. I said, look, here's the deal. Every woman wants a man who can stand on his own 2 feet, and they want to tell him when it's time to do it. Everybody smiled. That was the deal. So, yeah, we all want validation. That's what we get married very often thinking we're going to get. But the point is marriage can't operate when people need each other's validation because somebody has a bad day. And when you're lockstep at the hip for reciprocal validation, everything falls down. So even though we want validation, we also want sex. And you're not going to get both the same way that we think we're going to get it going in. On the back end of struggling with this, you get sex and validation. But the validation is, you know what? You're strong enough not to put up with my crap anymore. I'll tell you that. Now you're worth having sex with.
Dr. David Snarsh is my guest. He's a licensed clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author of Passionate Marriage and Intimacy and Desire. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at SMU in Plano to the Simmons School Counseling Program on the Sexual Ecology of Love Relationships. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is licensed clinical psychologist, certified sex therapist, and author David Snarsh. His books include Passionate Marriage and Intimacy and Desire, Awaken the Passion in Your Relationship. You can find information about his appearance this evening at SMU in Plano on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Eve in Dallas. Hi, Eve.
Hi. I have a question about single and mutual masturbation and how that affects the couple's desire for each other.
Thanks for your call. What are you laughing? You're not supposed to laugh at these questions.
Oh, I'm certainly not laughing at the caller. I'm laughing because, number one, I'm willing to bet that a certain percentage of the audience just, you know, had a brain infarct with the talk about masturbation. And the other part I'm laughing is because it's such a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And I deal with this stuff all the time. Masturbation is a very volatile topic, but it's volatile because people really very often don't want to get down and deal with the dynamics behind it. So the issue is not, is it a sin or not? Okay. Most reasonable people would agree if what you're doing is you're masturbating and you're depriving your partner and it's aimed that way, that's a no-no. Okay. But that's not the issue. masturbation, including mutual masturbation, is what this caller talked about. For a lot of people, that's getting real close to one of the most intimate thing that two people can do, much more so than intercourse. When you have an intercourse, you can blame whatever you're doing on your partner.
Right. We know that's not a private moment in any situation.
Well, unfortunately, for a lot of people, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You tune out your partner, you fantasize, mm-hmm. you focus on the feeling in your loins. When you get to the point that intercourse is the most intimate thing that two people can do, you've hit one of the pinnacles of human development. It takes a long time to get intercourse to that. But talk about mind mapping in sex. When two people are masturbating in front of each other, they are opening their minds to each other. They're saying, this is what I do in private. If you want to see what really cranks my cord, here it is. I'm showing you things I don't show anybody. Also, what it is you have to validate yourself in terms of what you really like. And that's really tough for people. So this mind mapping goes on about, are you just going through the motions, or are you looking at me while you're doing you? And are we really doing this?
I mean, this
is so adult. A lot of people would think of it as immature. It's more adult than a lot of people can do. So for a lot of couples, that's not where they start. That's later on. But because it really pushes intimacy, it is you get to see me. And this eye-to-eye contact when you're masturbating that way is the antithesis of missionary position. Missionary position was designed to destroy sex by getting people ear-to-ear so you couldn't see each other. And unless both people are just focusing down between their legs, you're looking at each other and you're letting your partner into your mind. And people's eroticism is much more personal than their bodies. I know lots of women have issues about body image, and they have issues about they don't want to get on top because they'll see their cellulite and things like that. But there's no liposuction for soul. You can always go get your saddlebags removed. And so people are a lot more defensive about what really cranks their cord. What is their and that's what eroticism is. It's not reducible to behavior. But when you're masturbating in front of each other, it's right there between the two of you. So that's a real issue. And there are couples that fight about that, where one is saying, come on, why don't we do this? And the other's going, oh, I think it's immature. But it's the real issue is I can't validate what I do. I'm afraid of that. I hide that as opposed to let's do this together.
So if they want to do it, what do you say to couples who want to get there, but right now one or both of them feel uncomfortable with the idea?
Well, I say, well, you know, you can do it this way. You can get in front of each other, get a little lubricant, particularly for the guy. That helps. Okay. You don't have to have friction burns to do this thing, and you don't have to pay for your sins. But why don't you get down in front of each other and both of you close your eyes? And you can both pretend that nobody's there. And if you want to take the next step, each of you could open your left eye. So this way, you get to see your partner, but it looks like they're not looking at you. So you can feel much better. And if you really want to be daring, you can open up both eyes. And it sounds funny. There are some people who take it serious. But what it really makes clear is if this is somebody that you know, then this is really an issue about how well do you really want to be known. And if you're dating, boy, are you setting up the rules of this relationship. The person who's saying, come on, let's do this, particularly if it's the woman who's going, come on, let's go. That is a woman who's saying to this guy, hey, we stay together. I am not going to be walking three steps behind you. And if I'm actually doing a screening device. I don't like men who need their women to genuflect. And so here's the deal. The fish you catch is a function of the bait that you use. I'm doing this. This is what I'm going to be like later on. You want a real solid person? Put your hand down in your pants and we're going to have some fun. But it's no longer about genitalia anymore. And so that's, I think, the issue that this person is talking about. More power to her, by the way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. This kind of leads into my question, actually. How does the availability of sort of sexual imagery in television and films in our culture separate our attitudes about these things from the rest of the world? And I guess that's it. And if you'd like to make a comment about Charlie Sheen, that would be interesting, too. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I guess the only comment I would make about Charlie Sheen is he is one more demonstration about how very sad people can rise to prominence in our society. That's all I think I really need to say there. In terms of the attitudes on TV and in the media, I just came back from Taiwan, actually, where women trafficking is a real issue there, mm-hmm. and they are very concerned about what shows up in the erotica and what shows on TV. And they actually showed us films of the girl groups from South Korea, which are so blatantly sexual. I think the trouble with all the explicit media that's on TV, I think one thing it does is it just sort of desensitizes us in a way that isn't good for us. The other thing that it does is it makes us feel inappropriately liberal. When I was in Sweden, I was talking with the professionals there, and they said the biggest problem that the Swedes have is they say to themselves, we're Swedish. We invented sex. Not appropriate to have sexual difficulties. Hmm. And they have all the sexual difficulties that we do. Plus, they have the feeling we're supposed to be liberal.
We're above this somehow.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, if you really watch what's being broadcasted on TV, these are not positive messages. You know, somebody has sex and then they get pregnant, or it's with somebody else's spouse, or it's very, very rare to see really healthy sexuality on TV, as opposed to in other countries where we're not as crazy about this. And it's a much more wholesome view of sexuality that you end up seeing on TV. So a lot of the kids, for instance, like MTV, and by the way, I have a 22-year-old daughter now, and so I went through raising a kid, and I have lots of difficulty with the imageries that these kids are being bombarded with. So, for instance, when they showed the films of the South Korean girls who are all skimpily dressed, I mean, they all look like hookers, mm-hmm. and I was at a room full of college kids, I looked at them and I said, how many of you think that all these girls are multiply orgasmic? And then it dawned on them, the pressure that these girls feel. None of these girls are going to be as hot as they look on TV. And
so even they're not what they appear to be.
No. It takes years, decades, to really become a sexually mature man or woman. Humans have the longest postnatal sexual development of any animal on the face of the earth. And being ready for copulation and reproduction means that you're just at the beginning. You don't know anything. There is this inappropriate pressure that's being put on children and adults, even grown adults, to think that everybody's having wonderful sex and everybody's swinging from the chandeliers. And of course, if you're a sex therapist like me, you're absolutely fabulous in bed and you never have difficulty.
So is there pressure on you too?
There was until I wrote Passionate Marriage and I basically said, I'm not playing this game. I have the mm-hmm. same difficulties as everybody else. We just know how to take care of it better.
Mm-hmm.
So this constant pressure to be fabulous body and fabulous, I mean, that's not reality. But the other problem is, aside from it's not reality, it detracts from the fact that the real issue about sex, particularly as you get older, is not what your body looks like. It's about being able to take somebody into your mind and heart. And putting your heart where you put your genitals is a tremendous emotional development for most of us. And so where most people think that adolescence is the sexual prime of life, if you want somebody who can pole vault into bed, there's nothing better than an adolescent boy. But if you want someone who can be intimate during sex, an 18-year-old boy is not going to let you look in your eye and figure out who he is before he does. When you are 40 or 50 years old and sexually mature and you're not perfect and you've had difficulties, that's when most people reach the pinnacle of their sexual development in their 40s and 50s and 60s, because it's about the person, not the body.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Sarah in Denton. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I had a question. My question is, after realizing or confronting the issue of a high desire and low desire partnership, how can you move on from this and make things a little bit more successful?
Thanks for your call.
Good. Well, one of the easy things is, if you read Intimacy and Desire, that's where the issues about low desire and high desire are being published for the very first time. And when people read that, it really helps them settle down. It stops making this adversarial. It begins to realize that low desire and high desire are very powerful ways of seeing all the issues in a relationship. And you begin to realize the high desire partner is just as stuck as the low desire partner. So just identifying high desire and low desire, that's the beginning. And when you begin to realize that all the high desire partners say the same thing and all the low desire partners say the same thing, and we can script your lines before you even tell us what's going on. The low desire high desire partner is saying, why don't you ever initiate? Low desire partner is saying, you never give me a chance. The high desire partner says, hell would freeze over until you made a move. Low desire partner says, you never wait and find out. How do you know?
You've heard this a time or two.
Oh, man. and see, but when I do this like tonight and you do this in front of 200 people, that's when people start to relax and they start to realize we're all in the same soup. This is about becoming part of the passing parade of people who just want to love each other, have a family, and move on with their lives. And you stop taking it personal about being the low desire or high desire partner. Or if you're the low desire partner, you can start initiating a lot and stick it to the high desire partner, because then it makes them the low desire partner.
Is it common for people, by the way, to crisscross
Absolutely.
That line?
Oh, yes. And it happens all the time. And this is where you realize it's not about your childhood. It's not about your personality. That's mm-hmm. the way people used to see it. It's just a position in a system. That's all it really is. And so helping people understand that everybody's stuck this way and this is not a problem. This is really the path to something absolutely beautiful. So, for instance, when the high desire partner gets it through his or her head that you can badger your partner into sex, but you can't force your partner to want you, it doesn't pay to push. Doesn't mean you got to give up sex forever. And it also means that when you are the low desire partner, you want to be able to say no. But again, everybody knows the phrase, if you can't say no, yes doesn't mean anything. But if you can't say yes, no doesn't mean anything. People aren't ready for that. They're ready to say no forever. Okay. And this is about realizing that the only way you're going to get what you want is you have to be able to make space for another human being in your relationship, and dominating your partner, you still lose. So there are relationships where the low desire partner holds sway. There are relationships when the high desire partner holds sway. When you realize this is a fight about whose limitations are going to limit the relationship. And living within your partner's limitations is not love. And so this pushing and shoving that goes on is really this elegant, co-constructed process of people working in teamwork, even if they don't think that they're teammates. Mm-hmm. That they are pushing and shoving each other into adulthood. And most of us don't like the sex we have because we're not mature enough yet to have the sex that we're angry that we don't have yet. Because it really takes mature people to be able to let it really let all hang out.
Dr. David Snarsh is the author of books including Passionate Marriage and Intimacy in Desire. He'll speak this evening about the sexual ecology of love relationships to the Simmons School Counseling Program at SMU in Plano. David, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. And I was just thinking for the last caller, this is exactly what we're going to talk about tonight. So come on down and say hello.
Perfect free event. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.